going to take any action. He asked me what did I expect when I came to a place where I knew I wasn't welcome. He warned me to keep Minnie Jean's expulsion in mind. February 19th. Andy, again. He's really beginning to frighten me. As I emerged from the cafeteria today, he walked right up, face to face, stepping on my toes so I couldn't move for a long moment. He shoved me backward and then held a wrench up to my face. He waved it around and shouted all sorts of threats that he could do a lot of awful things to my face with. My knees were shaking and I didn't know what to do. I said, "Thank you." His eyes grew huge. Quicker than the speed of light, I jumped away from him and ran. "Just think all night about what I'm going to do to you tomorrow," he shouted after me. February 20. I got hit across the back with a tennis racket. I managed to smile and say, "Thank you." Andy said, "What did you say, nigger?" I repeated, "Thank you very much." I spit up blood in the restroom. I felt as though someone had stuck a hot poker through my back, into my insides. I saw him several times during the afternoon, but I never let him see me cry, and I didn't report it to anybody. I think only the warrior exists in me now. Melba went away to hide. She was too frightened to stay here. School board cites inability to enforce compliance, asks U.S. court to halt integration. Arkansas Democrat, Friday, February 21st, 1958. U.S. won't get into Central High School case. Arkansas Democrat, Friday, February 21st, 1958. On Saturday, February 22nd, a day after the school board asked the court to halt integration, Minnie Jean left for New York. Even her departure was marred by a mob threat that delayed her American Airlines flight. Waving Minnie Jean off at the airport was difficult for all of us. There were lots of reporters and photographers taking pictures for the newspapers. We had become somewhat accustomed to their presence after all those months, and we were quite friendly with the ones from the North. We called them by their first names and frequently had off-the-record conversations with them. But just this one time, we were weary of their presence. It was a moment when we wanted to be alone with our pain. At first, we simply ignored them, behaving as though they were invisible. Still, even on this very sad day, we couldn't have them taking pictures of our tears. That would only be fodder for the segregationists. So we tried to pretend all was well. That night, I wrote in my diary, "My dearest friend Minnie Jean left today. I couldn't stop crying. People at the airport said we all looked very old and tired, for the battle must be getting harder. I pray Minnie Jean will be happy. She deserves it. Don't we all?" The Little Rock School Board had now petitioned the federal courts to consider again the whole question of school integration in light of its negative experience since September 3rd. By the beginning of March, I had sunk into the state of mind you get into when you know you have to take castor oil and there's no way out. I just did what had to be done without discussing it or thinking about it. I would get up, polish my saddle shoes, bathe, get dressed, dump my bowl of oatmeal into the toilet so Grandma India would think I'd eaten it, but my nervous stomach wouldn't have to eject it, and go to the war inside that school. I listened to shouts, to ugly names, while I smiled and said, "Thank you." I waited for a ride, came home, did homework, got to bed, and started over again the next day. I felt kind of numb, as though nothing mattered anymore. I thought my routine must be like a soldier's fighting in wartime. Only I was lucky enough to have weekends in another world. One day, I was doing just that, thinking about my other world and about the headline I had seen that read, "It's lovely," says Minnie Jean of her New York school. What would it be like to have just one lovely day of school amid pleasant people who smiled when you looked them in the eye? As I stood alone outside the 16th Street entrance of Central High, I was shivering against the cold, waiting for my ride home that Friday afternoon. I was immersed in fantasies about my quiet, safe weekend. My body was there, but my mind was somewhere else. My 101st guard, Danny, had said, "When you let yourself lose your focus, you make big mistakes." I suddenly realized that I had done just that, made a foolish mistake. The 16th Street entrance was one of the most dangerous areas of Central High's grounds. It was a place I would never have chosen to wait alone had I been conscious of my action. It was an isolated spot with no teachers, principals, or guards keeping watch. But I was too weary to walk the two blocks to the other side, where it was safer, and where my driver expected to pick me up. I decided I'd be wiser to stand still and hope that the carpool driver would figure out I wasn't waiting in the appropriate place and would come around to this side of the building looking for me. So I said a little prayer and allowed myself to lapse deep into my thoughts once more. Suddenly, there was a voice in the distance, calling my name, jolting me from my thoughts. "It's Nigger Melba!" It was Andy's voice shouting at me. My heart started beating fast. Where the heck was he? I looked to see how far off he was. He was more than a block away, coming up from the playing field with a group of his friends. They were walking fast, almost galloping. Even if I started running, I couldn't outdistance all of them. I looked around frantically, searching for help.
"Hey, Melba, you gotta get out of here."
The second voice was much closer. I wasn't alone. There was a sleek, muscular boy about 6 feet tall, wearing a varsity jacket and a cap, with a bushy shock of blonde curls peeking from beneath it. He was leaning against the passenger side of a 1949 Chevy parked at the curb, only a few feet to my left. Was he one of Andy's friends who'd come to corner me and hold me there? His face looked familiar to me. He resembled one of those big, tough boys who got their kicks taunting me. But why wasn't he coming toward me, shouting ugly words at me like the others? My mouth went dry. My feet seemed bolted to the ground. My knees were shaking so badly that I doubted whether I could run. Where would I go? Andy and his friends were dancing about each other in a circle, huddling to decide how they would have their fun with me. One boy started to run back in the direction from which they had come. Another boy joined them. What were they going back to get? I wondered. A rope?
"Nigger, nigger, on the wall. Who's the deadest of them all?"
Andy shouted as he hesitated, waiting for his friends. Now, they were only about a quarter of a block away.
"Stand still. Don't run. 'Cause if you do, it'll be worse for you,"
Andy shouted. What now? My mind scrambled to figure out what I should do.
"Melba,"
the blonde boy whispered my name.
"Listen to me. I'm gonna call you nigger, loud. I'm gonna curse at you, but I'm gonna put my keys on the trunk of this car. Get out of here, now. My name is Link. I'll call you later."
"But I can't do that."
"Get the hell out of here. Andy's gonna kill you."
"But I can't. I stood there gasping for words. He's up to something, I thought. Now I'm surrounded. Why doesn't the carpool driver come after me now? Right now. Please, God.
You don't have any choice, he whispered. Go!
I turned to see that Andy and his friends were only a short distance away. I wasn't even sure I could make it to the car. If you don't get out of here, you're going to get us both killed, the blonde boy urged.
Hey, Andy, we're going to have us some nigger tonight.
I heard Link shout as he walked away from the car toward them. I grabbed the keys and ran around quickly to open the door on the driver's side. I hopped in and locked all the doors. By the time I turned the key in the engine, Andy was clawing at the lock while the other boys popped off the windshield wipers and tried to get into the passenger side. Link stood glaring at me with an anxious look on his face, spewing hate words just like them. I pressed down the clutch, shifted into first gear, and the car jumped forward. Andy was still running alongside, holding on to the door handle, but as I sped up, he had to let go. Even if that boy Link got me later for stealing his car, I was alive and on my way for now. After a couple of blocks, when I could breathe a little easier, I craned to look around. I couldn't see anybody following me. Thank you, God, I whispered as I headed for home. Thank you for saving me one more time. 24. I gunned the engine of Link's car and began moving as fast as I could without attracting too much attention. By the time I rounded the corner at 12th and Cross and headed for the backyard, I felt myself going out of control. The car careened into our yard. I was moving so fast that I knocked down the fence my Uncle Charlie had begun to build around Grandma India's flower garden. Bolting from the car, I raced up to the back door. My heart was ticking like a time bomb. I looked around as I banged hard on the door. Maybe the police were sneaking up behind me, waiting to pounce. I thought of dumping the car someplace else, but where? Anywhere I parked, it would be noticed. In our closely knit neighborhood, everybody knew everybody else, and especially who owned which car.
Have you lost your mind, girl? Grandma said, wiping her hands on her apron as she held the screen door open and peered into the backyard. What's going on? Whose car is that?
She was stretching to see past me.
It belongs to a school friend. Let me in.
I motioned her to back away and then carefully latched the screen and locked the door behind me. Pulling the curtain back from the glass peephole in the door, I took one last look to see whether or not someone might be following me. I started to tell Grandma what happened.
You mean to tell me that car belongs to some Central High white boy?
She was horrified. I tried to calm her as I explained, but the expression on her face turned from astonishment to fear. Suddenly, she hurried to the linen closet and started frantically searching for something. She pulled out several torn and faded sheets and a whole bunch of safety pins. Dragging me with her, she rushed out the back door. We squared off the first sheet, holding its corners like we did to make the big bed in Mama's room, and then pulled it across the hood of the car.
Maybe you'll live to see tomorrow if we can hide this car from the police.
She motioned to me to help her stretch the second sheet across the roof of the car.
I suppose you were stuck twixt the devil and the deep blue sea, child. You done your best, but we got us some real trouble now.
We rushed into the house and locked the door behind us. When Mother Lois came home from teaching, she was just as upset as Grandma. After lots of questions and lots of pacing, she calmed down a bit.
Well, maybe this isn't so bad after all, she said. It's been a while and nobody's come to inquire about the car yet.
Grandma put her hands on Mother's shoulders and said,
Perhaps the boy was telling the truth. Who's to say that he can't be one of God's good white people?
I suppose, Mother said as her frown eased a bit. Let's assume for a moment that this boy wasn't trying to trap you. How are you going to get the call back to him without other people finding out about it?
Link said he'd call, I replied, as I began to search for ways of returning the car if he didn't. I surely couldn't drive it back to school the next day. He couldn't be seen in my neighborhood, and I dared not travel in his, especially not at night. Well, we would have to figure out a secret way. When the phone rang, I raced to pick up the receiver.
Hi, it's Link.
How do I know it's you?
My keychain has a little gold football on it.
Okay. Thank you, Link. Thank you very much.
Andy swears he's going to get you next time.
Yeah, he frightens me.
Look, we better hurry and get this car thing over with. Andy is suspicious that you drove away in my car. I told him no, it's a coincidence that it looked like mine. But I need to make sure he sees me driving my car.
Whatever you say. I whispered a prayer that Andy hadn't called the police.
Why don't you drop it off in front of Double Deck Ice Cream? Nobody would give it a second thought if we were there at the same time.
May I ask you a question?
Shoot.
Why did you do it? My curiosity was killing me. I had to ask.
Because he was real serious about killing you. Don't take his threats lightly. He means it. Hey, gotta go. Be there in a half an hour.
We couldn't risk asking a neighbor's help, so even though I didn't have a license, I had to drive Link's car downtown. I wondered what he must be like. The inside of the car was what Conrad called cherry, clean and polished as if he'd washed it twice a week. The record albums on the back seat were the same ones I might have chosen. Johnny Mathis, Sam Cooke, Elvis, and Pat Boone. Who was Link anyhow? Suddenly, I felt frightened. Maybe he was a member of the Klan. Maybe they were waiting with him for me to bring this car back, and they were going to grab me. I concentrated on my driving to get rid of those thoughts. I pulled up in front of Double Deck Ice Cream. Mama was right behind me. I looked all around to make certain there were no Central students who might recognize me. I parked Link's car at the curb, a little ways down from the front entryway. Leaving the keys beneath the floor mat on the driver's side, I walked back to our car. I couldn't resist taking a quick look around to see if I could spot Link. If he was there, I couldn't see him. I climbed into the passenger side of our car, and we were safely on our way home. The next day, when I saw Andy, he was walking past Mrs. Huckabee's office. There were two other teachers standing nearby, so although he growled at me, threatening that he would get me before the day was over, he kept walking. Each time I passed Link in the hallway, he winked at me. It was the one kind gesture in the morning filled with hellish activity. In the days that followed, every time I saw Link, he acknowledged me in some way. His wink or pleasant expression sometimes came just at the moment I needed to know I was alive and valuable. Otherwise, my days seemed to end with awful diary entries. March 11th. Today we had a film in gym. Shorthand class got very rough because my favorite teacher was gone. A boy entered the classroom to deliver a package. He began making a speech.
You all mean you're gonna let that there nigger sit there peaceful like that?
March 14th. Typing class is horrible. One girl tells me every day in a loud voice,
I don't believe in race mixing, especially with niggers.
March 15th. Maybe the weeks following, in which we have a little free time, will help me feel better. I must have time to figure out why life is like this for me. March 18th. Today, Tuesday, was my worst day in a long time. Ernie and I always leave the cafeteria together. Today he wasn't there, so I had to go alone. The crowds on the stairs called names. Nigger,
Spick. Indian. My knees shook so bad I thought I'd fall over. I had no choice but to walk up the stairs and through the thick of them. March 22nd. Went with Mom to the cleaners again today. The clerks are beginning to be very mean to us. We must stop going there immediately. They stare and talk too loud to us and attempt to make us appear silly. It's enough that I go through that at Central. Why should I have to endure it at the cleaners? March 23rd. The AME churches gave the 8 of us white Bibles with our names engraved on them during afternoon services. It made me feel like my people are supporting me. An article in the Gazette said that in a letter to Army Secretary Brucker, Roy Wilkins, Executive Secretary of the NAACP, said there had been 42 reported incidents of harassment of us from October to February. Of course, we knew that the number of incidents reported pale in comparison to what we really experienced as we walked the halls of Central High. These days, hostility was more often than not expressed through physical rather than verbal punishment. I had begun wondering once again whether or not we would make it through the year. Urgent calls to the president were not bringing about any change. Then, one night as I sat studying, Link called. Mother handed me the receiver with a questioning look. "Don't sit in your regular assigned seat for your first class tomorrow," he told me. "Take the seat nearest the window. I know you like to sit in the back of the third row so you can protect your back, but do as I say, just this one time." "How do you know where I usually sit?" "Never mind. Just do what I tell you." "Why?" "Because the segregationists have got real plans for you. You're definitely their new target because you're tall, you're pretty, you're uppity, not meek, the way they think your people should be. Besides, you hung around with Minnie Jean."
"What do you mean, uppity?"
"You know what I mean."
"Why are you warning me? What do you care?"
"I don't know. I gotta go. My dad's coming," he whispered. "Don't forget what I said."
He slammed down the phone abruptly. I sat for a moment, thinking about our conversation. I wondered why a white boy would take such risks. The next day, as I entered the classroom, I noticed something was different. The boys and girls who had earlier set my books afire, thrown spitballs, dumped water on my head, and called me names, were all sitting in the usually empty seats surrounding my assigned seat. I paused for a moment, and then my instincts told me to do as Link had said. I crossed the room to the opposite side and took a seat in the front row.
"Put the nigger back in her cage. Make her take her regular seat,"
one boy shouted. The teacher looked up at me for a moment, then looked back at the boy voicing the complaint. All along, she had shown she was not someone I could count on for any protection. She remained passive when students threw things at me or dumped water on my head.
"Melba, take your regular seat," she demanded.
"Yes, ma'am."
I stood obediently and walked toward my seat. What else could I do? To defy her order directly would be to risk expulsion. I got past the hurdles of feet stuck in the aisle to trip me. As I approached my seat, I could see there was something on it. Peanut butter. A 2-inch thick layer of peanut butter with shiny objects that looked like broken glass laced through it. How could Link have known about this plan ahead of time? He must be a part of their group. I moved back toward the seat I'd originally chosen. "There's something on my seat," I told the teacher.
"Take it off," she replied.
"Oh, I think I'll let somebody else do that," I said, as the group surrounding the peanut butter seat snickered. I slid back into my new seat by the window even before she could respond.
"Why's the nigger special? Why doesn't she have to obey orders?"
I raised my hand. The teacher acknowledged it. "Why are they special?" I asked. "Why are they allowed to be out of their seats today? It's musical chairs?" I looked her in the eye with an expression that telegraphed a message I hoped she'd understand. I wasn't about to move again. As class ended, members of the heckler's group, sitting around the peanut butter seat, were all whispering to each other. I was curious about how they planned to clean up the mess before the next class. When the bell rang, I stood, collected my books, and calmly walked out of the room. "Chalk one up to Link," I thought to myself. En route to lunch, as I approached my locker, I noticed the door was open. Someone had hammered the lock and dumped out my books. I had to go to Mrs. Huckabee's office to report the incident. I would need new books for afternoon class, and I would miss being with my friends for the full lunch period. I walked into the cafeteria after reporting my loss to Mrs. Huckabee and getting new books, to find that my friends had already left. I wondered why they had left early. Could it be that they had gone to look for me? As I settled down in my seat and began to unwrap the sandwich Grandma had made for me, I noticed a group of boys moving in close to me, much closer than usual. There had always been a wide path of empty chairs immediately surrounding our eating area because other students shunned us during the lunch period. Maybe they felt free to harass me so openly because this was one of those days when school officials were experimenting, seeing whether or not we could survive without uniformed, federalized troops or school officials posted where everyone could see them. There were no guards in the halls when we changed classes, no guards just outside the cafeteria doors, within shouting distance, as they often were. There were no officials pacing the floor or hugging the walls, observing what was going on. I began to get nervous. I could tell it was no accident that I was being surrounded by the group of sideburners who appeared to have mischievous plans for me. Were they gathering to block my way? To taunt me in front of all the others? In order to get out of the cafeteria, I would have to trudge through whatever barriers they erected. I would be in the same position Minnie Jean had been in. My palms were perspiring, my heart racing. Was there no way out? Just before the bell rang to end the period, a second group of about five of the same sort of boys entered the cafeteria and moved directly to a spot I was eyeing as a possible escape route. Now I was completely surrounded. The hostile gang glared and hissed at me. It was beginning. As I looked around, suddenly I saw him. There was Link, seated among my attackers, laughing, joking with them, behaving as though he were a regular member of the group. I studied him, waiting for his eyes to catch mine, and when they did, he looked down quickly. It both frightened and saddened me to see Link among those hoodlums. I stared at him in disbelief and anger. Had he pretended to be a nice person when he was just one of them? I struggled to regain my composure. As usual, I was seated near the main entryway with my back as near to the wall as I could get so that my rear would be protected. But with those boys becoming more vocally hostile every moment and the guards absent, my safe seat seemed to be a trap. I looked off into the distance, where some of my people were serving food from behind the counter. There was no way any of them could help me. There must have been 1,000 or so students in that huge room. It was near the beginning of the second lunch period, a time when the cafeteria was most crowded. Even above the ear-shattering levels of conversation that blended into a hodgepodge of unsettling noise, I could hear my attackers' comments shouted at me. Over and over again they were saying how they were going to come and get me and what they would do with me. I was trying to ignore them, concentrating instead on a plan for my escape, when a milk carton came flying at me, hitting me on the forehead. It was followed by something that pierced my cheek. It took a moment to realize one of the boys had been a bean shooter. I flinched, but braced myself so I would not show a reaction, even though the prick was painful. I had to look straight at the group in order to keep tabs on them. I looked directly at Link, sitting there as big as you please, a part of their group. Lending me his car must have been part of a master plan, I decided. I ducked down quickly to avoid a hard white object that came whizzing through the air. I narrowly averted the missile, and when I reached to examine it, I found a golf ball wrapped in paper. Remembering my discussion with Grandma about playing mind games, I examined it as if it were a precious treasure. I smiled and gushed, loud enough for those sitting closest to me to hear. It's just beautiful. Thank you. It's just what I need. My hecklers began mumbling among themselves. They were far enough away that I couldn't hear exactly what they were saying, but I watched the puzzled expressions on their faces. They looked at me as if I had lost my mind. I glanced at Link to see his reaction. It was hard to read. I had to stop wondering about Link and figure out what to do. Don't do anything, the voice in my head kept repeating. I reached into my satchel and pulled out the book on Gandhi that Grandma had given me, along with some blank sheets of notebook paper, and pretended I was studying. I decided I would make my attackers believe I was settling in for a long study session. After all, my next class was study hall, and if I cut it, I wouldn't be missing anything important. Recently, school officials had issued a warning about students who initiated attacks. The penalty was suspension. I suspected that as long as I remained in my seat, no one was going to walk over and dump soup on my head or attack me. With all those other students seated close enough to watch what was going on, my attackers would want it to appear that I made the first move, forcing them to retaliate. When the bell rang, the room became even more noisy with people shoving chairs, finding their books, and rushing toward the exit. I desperately wanted to get out of there, but I knew full well I couldn't move or the group would start a fight and set me up for expulsion, for sure. Word was they had psychological experts training them in ways of forcing us to respond. I was willing to sit in that spot until the end of time rather than risk a fight. I was already wearing band-aids on my heels from the heel walkers the day before, and I was sore up and down the back of my legs from being kicked. I felt I couldn't take any more. I knew I couldn't help but fight back against the next person who attacked me. I pretended to become intensely involved in my book. I was reading about Gandhi's prison experience and how he quieted his fears and directed his thoughts so that his enemies were never really in charge of him. All at once, I was aware that one of my hecklers was coming toward me.
Niggers are stupid. They gotta study real hard, don't they?
He said in a loud voice. Thanks for the compliment, I said, looking at him with the pleasantest expression I could muster so he would believe I wasn't annoyed.
Study hard now, nigger bitch, but you gotta leave this place sometime. And then we got you.
Thank you, I said again, a mask of fake cheer on my face. He seemed astonished as he slowly started to back away. I felt myself smiling inside. As Grandma India said, turning the other cheek could be difficult, but for me, it was also beginning to be a lot of fun. Somehow I had won a round in a bizarre mental contest. My heart slowed its rapid beating, and my hands stopped shaking. I felt safer, even comfortable, as something inside me settled to its center. I had a powerful feeling of being in charge. I was no longer allowing hecklers' behavior to frighten me into acting a certain way. For that moment, I was the one making decisions about how I would behave.
a little choir of voices in my head was singing. Hallelujah. 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 The second bell rang for the beginning of the next period. By that time, students were expected to be settled into their seats. I saw Link beckon the hecklers into a huddle. From the expressions on their faces, I could tell there was serious conversation about what to do next. All at once, the group, led by Link, made their way to the door.
Hey, I'm not going to stay in detention hall every morning for a week just for a little nigger-beating pleasure,
I heard Link say as he passed close by me. I heard them arguing with each other, heard some of them agree that it would be worth it if they could get me once and for all. But I heard Link's voice as he said it was better to leave now, and he'd help them get me later for sure.
25.
I did it!
I shouted with excitement as I raced in the front door where Grandma was standing in her usual place to welcome me home after school.
Did what?
She asked. I tried to do some of the things Gandhi talks about, you know, keeping calm in your own mind no matter what's going on outside.
Phone's for you, Melba,
Conrad yelled from the hallway. I hoped it would be someone I could share my victory with, maybe Vince, but it was Link. I slammed the receiver down. Right away, the phone started to ring again. I picked up and said,
"Don't bother to call again."
I slammed the receiver down once more. Again, it rang and rang. Grandma walked into the hallway and eyed me suspiciously. I picked up the receiver for fear of having to explain to her.
5 minutes. That's all I ask, Link said. I saved your skin. At least you owe me a chance to explain.
Absolutely not, I said, but he cut me off before I could finish.
I didn't want to be there, but I heard they were going to do something big to you in the cafeteria. So I thought if I was there, I could do something to help you.
How did you know they were planning something?
My dad makes me go to those meetings where they plan what to do to get you all kicked out of school.
Why are you telling me this?
Because I want to help you.
I can't trust you after today.
Hey, if I hadn't convinced those guys to leave, they were going to get you. And if you don't believe I'm on your side, here's proof. Listen up. Stay off the far end of the second floor tomorrow, and don't go to your locker after lunch.
I gotta go. Grandma wants me. She was standing over me, looking as though she were upset with me. I rushed to the kitchen with her following on my heels. I had to tell them what had happened, and it was only a matter of minutes before Mother and Grandma tore into me. Mother Lois was first to speak.
We have to wonder about Link's motives.
Then Grandma said,
perhaps he's trying to set you up for the Klan. He's gonna lure you into a trap. And then where will you be?
Although I, too, was undecided about trusting Link, I continued to defend Link as both of them came up with dozens of reasons why I shouldn't trust this white boy. Still, there was something inside me that said he had taken a big risk giving me his car that day. I didn't want to defy Mother and Grandma, but Link was inside Central. He understood what I was going through. They could not help me inside that school. I had no choice but to take any help that would enable me to survive. I had to take the risk of trusting Link a little bit, at least for now. Sure enough, the next day, I heeded Link's warnings, taking a different route to class. Later, I heard there was trouble on the route I usually took. By not going to my locker in the afternoon, I avoided meeting someone who must have been very angry, as he or she broke the lock and shredded the contents of the locker. The day had gone exactly as Link had said it would, but even so, I found myself wondering if he were only building my trust in order to lay a bigger trap for me.
NAACP asks sterner action by Central High School troops. Arkansas Gazette, Tuesday, April 1, 1957. The NAACP renewed today its demand for more militant action by troops at Central High School. Otherwise, we are confronted with the incredible spectacle of the government of the United States placing the burden of enforcing the order of its courts upon the slender shoulders and young hearts of 8 teenage Negro students. Link warned me that with the beginning of April, segregationists would feel compelled to speed up their efforts in order to get us out of Central before we could complete a full school year. Some of their tactics became desperate, and their desperation made it easier for me to avoid the more obvious traps they set. Still, on the pages of my diary, there was no real life anymore. It was as if my days consisted of only one thing, enduring pain in my mind and on my body. April 2nd. Today we had a fire drill. I was very much afraid. There was pushing on the stairs and name-calling. I almost lost my balance. Had I fallen down those 30 or so stone steps, I would have hurt myself or even been killed. They tried hard enough, that's for sure. April 4th. Excitement over the Mikado makes me very sad. I hear they will spend much money on costumes and makeup to have a real grown-up production. Oh, how I wish I could participate. Also, the class play will be soon. All this drama would be wonderful for me, since that is the field I might go into. I spend equal amounts of time daydreaming about becoming a news reporter and an actress. I wonder why I'm so close, and yet the distance of a million miles away from this opportunity. April 8th. The boys are throwing lighted paper at me in study hall again. Oh, well, not too much longer. It made me very unhappy to read today's headline in the Gazette. A man named Thomas is proposing that all of us withdraw from Central and everybody support his voluntary plan for desegregation. He's some businessman, president of First Pyramid Life Insurance Company. The long and the short of it is that he wants to set up all kinds of biracial boards and committees, and eventually, somewhere, eons from now, maybe we'd have integrated schools. Pooh. Everybody important that suggests we withdraw just makes it harder for us. April 9. It feels so scary because the adults here don't know what to do. I believe the rational ones who would keep the violence in check are being controlled by those who want us out at any cost. Therefore, nobody is steering the ship. Nobody's in charge. Not really. I can see that it's possible we could have a riot within this school. April 10. Today was very, very hard. I had to get up and walk out of study hall. A boy stood over me shouting insults while the teacher and entire study hall looked on. He threatened to kill me right there. April 11th. I don't think I could have lasted another minute. I hope somebody performs a miracle over this weekend. Do you hear me, God? In the days that followed, Link continued to phone me every night. Grandma India would hand me the receiver with a scowl on her face, but neither she nor Mother Lois forbade my talking with him. Sometimes Grandma even stood by, listening to the entire conversation with arms folded and a huffy attitude. It was the first time I had ever continued to do something I knew very well they didn't want me to do. But still, they put up with it. I think Mother finally realized that Link was doing something for me they could not do, feeding me vital information that could help me survive. Whenever they confronted me with questions about our conversations, I told them the truth.
Link and I mostly talked of which restrooms to avoid, routes I might take to avoid special plans to terrorize me, how to get inside a classroom safely, and where to sit. He also explained some of the traditions and activities at Central High to me that I could not know otherwise. He described some of the regular school activities, as well as segregationist plans, moods, and behavior. I learned there were many secrets among school officials, many significant things taking place without our even being told about them, let alone being asked to participate. Link swore me to secrecy, so other than mother and grandmother, none of the other 7 students knew he existed. Occasionally, during a general conversation about do's and don'ts, I would share some information that I thought would be helpful to them, but otherwise, I kept my mouth shut. I figured I owed Link that. After a while, having him as my friend got to be fun for both of us. We played a cloak and dagger game, passing notes in books and such, but we never spoke to each other in school, or walked near each other, or acknowledged each other except with our eyes for fear he would get caught. He continued hanging around with Andy and his friends and attending the segregationist strategy meetings. He said the worst part of it for him was that he felt himself a traitor. He was torn between his loyalty to his family and friends and his sense of guilt and responsibility for what was happening to the 8 of us. Sometimes he justified what he was doing by saying, if he protected me and prevented a major catastrophe from befalling any of the 8 of us, he could ensure some of his normal graduation activities, and besides, people wouldn't think Central such an awful place. Meanwhile, we did indeed notice some stronger efforts by a few teachers to discipline students. The Little Rock School Board now demanded belligerent students be brought under control. At first, we saw no difference, but we began to notice a slight bit of peace in the hallways, and we were heartened to hear that another girl had been expelled for handing out the card saying, 1 down, 8 to go. Easter. What a wonderful word, I thought to myself as I walked to Grandma's room. If Easter Sunday was coming soon, it meant the end of school was only weeks away. The 29th of May. What would that last day of school at Central High be like? Tonight's the night, Grandma said, making the announcement from her perch in her favorite chair. We're going into the trunks tonight. It's time to make your selections. She smiled with her all-knowing expression because she was fully aware of how much it delighted us to view and touch her trunk treasures. There were gifts, heirlooms, and mementos we got to touch or see only at Christmas or Easter. There they were in the center of the room, the old trunks given to Grandma India as a young girl. One was a deep brown, with scrapes and scratches visible beneath the glossy veneer she kept up with biannual waxing. The second one was a deep garnet color and looked newer. Have you given much thought to what you'll be wearing to church this Easter, Melba? Grandma India asked as she lifted the lid of the first trunk. I had thought long and hard about wanting to dress grown up. The strength growing inside me to face the hostile students at Central had leaked into my home life. Now it bubbled up in me, allowing me to speak my mind. I'd like to wear nylon stockings and little heels with whatever I wear. I am 16 now, 16 and a half, actually. It was a daring suggestion, considering Grandma's opinions on the subject. Nylon stockings. Heels. Have you been reading those trashy fashion magazines again? Let's not move too fast, young lady. You've got all your life to wear stockings, but you'll only be young once. Grandma seemed adamant about my remaining a 2-year-old, I thought to myself. It was the only thing she and Papa Will agreed on. He thought wearing nylon stockings and dating should begin at age 20, but since he didn't live with us, I knew what he thought wouldn't have to be the rule for what happened in my life. But Grandma was right there, keeping me from growing up. Nevertheless, as she fussed and fumed about my wicked desires, I kept my expression pleasant, the same as I did in the halls of Central High, in order to avoid expulsion.
"Let's take some time to think about the stockings," Mother Lois said, smiling and moving toward the trunk to peek inside. "Tonight, we'll pick our special cloth from the trunks and get going on a design for all of our dresses and for Conrad's shirt."
"Lois, maybe something two-piece would be nice for Melba this year,"
Grandma said, as Mother nodded her head yes and knelt beside the trunks. The silky waves of her hair fell down to her waist. Meanwhile, I was taking time to corral my thoughts. I wanted them to ask me what I wanted to wear. As the discussion about my outfit continued without me, I felt the same as I did at Central when people talked over and around me. I felt power surging up in me once again, so I had to speak up for myself. "I want a grown-up outfit, a suit kind of thing that will be okay for school and church and look nice over my crinoline." Grandma seemed taken aback by my forwardness. My Easter dress had been a decision she and Mother had made up until then. I could see her pondering whether to send me off to my room or to humor me. Then she said,
"Well, young lady, seems you have strong opinions, but I guess you have a right. You've grown up a lot. Why don't you tell us exactly what you want?"
Then her eyes lit up as she withdrew fabric from the trunk. Her enthusiasm always peaked during discussions about fashion. She adored designing and making new clothes. Mama and Grandma could draw a picture, then sit in the middle of the floor and cut a pattern out of newspaper and make a dress come to life in the fabric. For the next hour, we rummaged through Grandma's trunks, filled with fabrics she had collected over the years. There were remnants of dresses and suits I had seen her wear all my life. There were brand new pieces and full bolts she had gotten from her mother before she died, or from her sisters as trades for other things. Easter was always a time when we each were allowed to choose the cloth we wanted. Celebrating the Easter holiday was a big event in our family. Attending church on Easter was a grand ceremony when everybody dressed up in the very best they could afford. There was always an Easter egg hunt on the church grounds and a parade of people in special hats. A few weeks back, we had officially begun the sacred holiday with the pledge of our sacrifices for Lent. It was a family tradition that Mama and Grandma would review our Lenten commitment as we shopped the trunks.
"Have you two considered adding more items to your sacrifice list this year?"
Grandma asked as she began to sketch the design for my dress.
Great Bet Colas, that's what I'm doing without. I haven't slipped yet," I declared, thinking how many times I thought about slipping.
"That's all?"
Grandma's tone let me know she wasn't pleased with either the number or quality of sacrifices on my list. One year, I had chosen to give up the radio and another candy bars. I knew for sure I would never promise to give up either of those again.
"Well, what about giving up television to spend more time reading your Bible?"
Grandma said.
"Oh, Mother, Grandma, please, since I'm giving up so much in Central, can't you let me slide by this year?" I pleaded with them as I sat caressing the thick folded piece of purple velvet I had pulled from the trunk to covet. The scent of cedar balls was beginning to fill the room.
There's lots of hard work to be done on repenting for sins. Have you listed your sins?
As Grandma spoke, she rocked back and forth a little faster and turned her attention away from her sketching to look at me. I've lumped together into one big sin all the hundreds of times I thought evil of people at Central, I said. There were also several times I thought about sassing adults back, mostly teachers and principals at school, and I didn't trust God on two occasions.
And how about not answering all your fan mail? Mother Lois added. Don't you think it is a sin to ignore all those people who take their valuable time to write to you? You were so good about it at first.
I realized she was right. At the beginning, I had faithfully answered those letters each weekend. They came from France, Germany, England, Africa, and Australia, from people all around the world, mostly congratulating me for going to Central High. Grandma would sift out the mean ones, which were few and far between. I got several marriage proposals from cute boys, some of them white, who sent their pictures. Grandma forbade me to send them more than a polite thank you. I wanted at least to learn more about them and file them in an "If you need a husband when you're a grown-up" file. But Grandma said that would be a personal sin. Meanwhile, back at school, I feared my grades would suffer horribly because I couldn't concentrate. Every moment of every day was filled with awful surprises that began early each morning. I hoped and prayed I wouldn't get ejected before the end of school. I took heart because I could see signs of the kind of student activities that only come near the end of the school year. Late one evening, Link telephoned. He was furious about the announcement of the cancellation of many of his senior class activities. He spoke of all his hard work to maintain good grades, his athletic awards, and his student leadership, and now his hopes for a wonderful senior year were dashed. The traditional senior events had been canceled because of the possibility of trouble as a result of integration. School officials also cited the presence of the Arkansas National Guard as another reason. Link was inconsolable. I don't know what I can do about it, I said, even as I wondered whether his disappointment and anger would make him turn against me.
You can do a news interview, saying we're not such bad people and that everything is getting better at school. That way, everybody in the world won't think we're all villains.
Link, you don't want me to lie, do you? Everything is getting worse, not better. On and on he went, telling me how Central High students were suffering and sacrificing the reputation of their nationally acclaimed school because we had come there. He was more angry than I'd ever heard him.
This was a good school, ranked high on the national scale, and now our halls are filled with soldiers, and people are treating us like criminals.
I could only think to tell him to have faith that God would make things okay. I couldn't do what he asked. I couldn't change things. That's when he really got sarcastic, saying,
"Don't give me that God stuff. That's what Nana Healy always says. I don't believe in God. If he's there, why is he letting all this happen?"
Who's Nana Healy?
My nanny. She's colored, like you.
He had often spoken of her, but this was the first time he had told me she was not white. The reason I'm attending Central is so I don't have to spend my life being somebody's nanny, I said in a tone to match his indignant manner. By the end of the conversation, Link's anger had shifted from me to the situation. He was frustrated, vowing he was going to do something about the cancellation. Our conversation aroused my suspicions anew. Was he just being nice to me temporarily
to get me to lie to the news people? Who was he? After all, I had no way of checking him out. I couldn't tell the others about him or talk about him to the NAACP people. I was at his mercy, having to decide on my own whether or not he was genuine. I would have